originating from our Jimmy John's of Lexington studios. This is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
But it was all for Chuck McGee. Super Sabre wins the Derby for Todd Fletcher.
Basalt will give trainer Steve Asmussen career win number 6,000.
It was all have another for Doug O'Neill.
Oxbow and D-Wayne Lucas. Trainer D-Wayne Lucas, a sixth win.
And Al's Rosie is going to give trainer Gary Contessa his 2,000th career win.
And Dialed In never got to them. It was Animal Kingdom for Graham Motion.
Steve Hobby with career victory number 1,000 at Oaklawn.
Now here's Jude Feld.
Good evening, everyone, wherever you may be. Trainer Talk is on the air. This broadcast, sponsored by Fasig Tipton, is the show that trainers listen to. I'm Jude Feld, and I'm in our Jimmy John's of Lexington studio, delighted to spend the next hour with you and our special guest. Tonight's trainer has been in the business since 2017. At this recording, he has won 38 races in 266 starts, with 40 second-place finishes and 30 thirds while amassing over $1 million in earnings. Irish-born and Maryland-based, his career in the thoroughbred sport has taken a long and winding road to success. Welcome to Trainer Talk, Jeremiah O'Dwyer.
Hi, Jude. How are you?
Good, good. Your friends call you Jerry, right?
They do, yeah. I mostly go as Jerry, but then I kind of, you know, on all the forms, they always ask you for your given name, basically. So I always put down Jeremiah, and people that do, when they get to know me, everybody calls me Jerry.
Yeah, that's what's in the form, Jeremiah. So
yeah.
If anybody's looking you up,
that's it, yeah.
We want to make sure they get the right name.
The right name is right, yeah.
Well, it was written about you that you were born in County Tipperary, Ireland. It said O'Dwyer developed his love of horses, as many young children do, on the backs of chubby, rotten little ponies. Were they really chubby and rotten?
I think we used to have donkeys there as well. The donkeys were more rotten. They'd be trying to rub you off under a bush or something. The ponies are a little better.
Just slightly, huh?
Yeah, just slightly. But, you know, whatever you could throw your leg over when you were young, you were going to do it, you know?
Yeah.
That's the fun when you're a kid. You're fearless and you do stupid stuff all the time. And most of the time you get away with it. You don't come out unscathed.
How far back do your roots in horse racing go?
Fairly far, I suppose, as well. But I didn't grow up around thoroughbred. So my dad, he worked for the postal service in Ireland, and he was they come from a big family. But his dad was a blacksmith, and he used to have a forge. So he used to always, back in the day, you know, nobody in Ireland had money. There was no horse trailers and stuff. So when people wanted their horses' shoes on, they'd bring them to the forge, you know, whether it be walked up the road, or my dad and his brothers would go to the neighbors and bring the horses up for them and take them back home, you know. So he used to be always riding, and everything was, like, fair back then, you know. So my dad, like, loved horses from then, and he just always had, like, ponies and stuff, and there's like lots of horse fairs in Ireland, so he really liked the wheeling and dealing, you know. It was like his hobby, going to horse fairs there on weekends, and that's how I started, just him always having some ponies or donkeys or something out the back. And I was a bit obsessed, because every essay I ever did in school was horse related, or metalwork was a horse object, or woodwork, you know. People used to laugh at me a fair bit, because everything was, you know, horses. And growing up in primary school, like, I didn't know what race horses were. We just loved horses, and it didn't matter what they were. So I kind of just later on, when I used to start doing, like, some cross-country trials and show jumping and that, one lady where I used to keep my pony and ride with her a bit, she told me about Tommy Stack, who was a trainer close to us. And people don't know him. He's He's actually very famous back there. He rode Red Rum to win the Grand National, and he's a Group 1 winning racehorse trainer back in Ireland. Very good guy, and I learned a lot going down there. I used to just go down there on the weekends and school holidays when I was like 13, 14. It was my first introduction, and I'll never forget, my first horse was called Anti-Plan. It was the first race horse I ever got up on. I don't think he won very much, but he was quiet and good to learn on. And Paddy Crow was the guy who got me up on him, and he's just, you know, fond memories, you know, learning how to do it and very eager to work, you know. Didn't get paid very much, you know, he was getting paid by a small few pounds and get to be around the horses. So kind of that's where I started, you know, just riding out there a little bit. And they had a bug boy or apprentice jockey, we call him in Ireland, there, and he was the one that told me about the racing school in Ireland, which I never knew existed either. And that takes on like 30 students every year. So I kind of just sent in an application for that on a whim, not knowing that they do a 2-week trial up there. So 2-week trial for like 60, I think, applicants every year. They do a 2-week trial and then they select 30. So obviously you're going up there and you're doing your best. And you don't, this place too, you don't have to know how to ride. They teach you, start you from the bottom up. You don't have to have a background in horses. But, you know, I was able to ride at the time, luckily enough. But I got accepted anyway after the 2-week course. And my parents, they didn't want me to go. They wanted me to finish school, my education first, and then go. But luckily enough, I wore them down and they were good. And they let me finish up school early and go up to the racing apprentice school in Ireland, which was a great experience. We were taught a lot by the Irish Army, their equitation division, and they were very much into the discipline of everything. You know, you'd muck the stalls properly, no wastage of straw, horses were done immaculately, yourself had to be presented immaculately. It was just great discipline and the way things should be done.
That's, you know, a great program, huh?
It was, yeah. They don't do the army thing anymore, but they have their own, they've built their own facilities now, which are fabulous, in County Kildare. They just have a great team there, and it's, you know, it's run by the state, so you know, we used to actually get paid to go there. You know, we just get a bit of pocket money to go there. So it was great. You know, you're basically getting paid to have an education.
Yeah, that's fantastic. I read that when you got accepted to the school, you got assigned to David Hanley, who's now Windstar Farms general manager. Talk about that a little bit.
Oh, I did. Yeah, David. I'm still good friends with him today. It was fabulous, you know. Like, David lives and breathes horses, and I went out there just loving horses but not knowing too much. And, you know, he was great to educate you, take the time, and, you know, he'd explain stuff to you. Like, I was, you know, he was putting me on a lot of horses to, you know, gallop and breathe and bring me along and give me my first ride in a race, give me my first winner in a race. Is very instrumental, you know, having somebody like him who has a love for horses and passionate about getting to the next level. You know, he was never happy with just having, like, lowly rated horses. You know, he'd go to the sales, he'd pick out nice horses, and did a fabulous job in training them. Had some good connections and some great staff there and nice horses. So, you know, I was a little disappointed, all right, when he told me he was packing up and going to America, but I was still young at the time and determined to become a jockey, so I moved to the other side of the Curragh to Michael Halford, who also another very good trainer and very, you know, you learn great horsemanship skills in Ireland, you know. They're very, you know, not to blow around, but they're very skilled and knowledgeable in horse care and development and doing right by the horses.
Well, it's been a sport, you know, in Ireland for, you know, a long time. before it was in the United States, and just a magnificent place for a racehorse, with the beautiful grass and the race courses seemingly on almost every corner.
Yeah, there is. There's nearly every county has a racetrack. I don't think there's that many that don't. And some of them have a couple. You know, my own county, Tipperary, has three. You know, which I've been fortunate enough to get a ride around all of them. I got winners around all of them. Had falls around a few of them as well. So, but it is. It's great. You know, a very competitive race in Ireland. Very good horses and very good jockeys and very good trainers. So it's very tough there. You know, you have to be on your game to be competitive there and make it.
Yeah, it's really a epicenter of racing. It's one of the big places to be in Europe. What got you hooked on the sport? Once you got in it and became a jockey and stuff, what really piqued your passion?
Just being around the horses, and then when you get on them, and you realize how fast they can go. You know, there's no greater feeling than sitting on a good horse. You know, even if you just start riding horses, and when you sit on a good one, you know you're on a good one. It's like the difference between driving a Toyota Corolla and a Ferrari. You know, the Toyota Corolla can get the job done, but the Ferrari just gives you that whole. Gets your adrenaline going and excitement going. It's totally different. And when you sit in a few good ones and realize what they are capable of doing, what they want to do, that they can't do enough to please you. You know, the good horses, just professional athletes, they want to go out there, do their job, you point them in the right direction, and they'll give you everything they've got and then some.
Yeah, well, it's amazing how like the smartest horses are always the best horses, and when you do have those horses that are really good and they're breezing in the morning and you see them get low, you know, they say get low for the dough, how they stretch out and they get like almost like a race car. You can see that sometimes when they're breezing, and that's really an exhilarating feeling.
It really is, you know, and people always ask you, you know, how do you know the good horses? It's from repetition of looking at horses and being around them. You know, you get that feeling. It's about experience and keep looking and looking. People, you know, there's all these textbooks and everything on, confirmation and how horses should be, you know. But eventually you're trying to get your own style of horse that you like. You know, I might like a grade one horse that you don't particularly like, and you might like a grade one horse that I don't particularly like, but they're both equally good, you know?
Right. it's a difference of opinion that makes horse racing, right?
Exactly. You know, it's only, I always say it's only a beauty contest when they're in the sales ring. After that, it's just sheer ability.
Yep. In case you tuned in late, this is Jude Feldman. We're visiting with trainer Jeremiah O'Dwyer on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. You know, when you talk about that and you see two different horses, I remember one day when I was working for Keeneland, had to be like around 2002 or 3, and I'm in the walking ring and I'm watching these horses walk around for the grade one, and they're turf horses, they're marathon horses, and some of them were, you know, pretty homely. And then you always have the other ones that are, you know, big, strong, strapping, good-looking horses. And, you know, it didn't really seem to matter. They all had, you know, excellent records. I mean, it was a grade one, or it might have been a grade three, but they were all good horses. And just, you know, the different looks between them, horses can come from anywhere.
They can, in all shapes and sizes. You know, little horses are little talking rockets, you know, and big horses might be big and slow. Like you said, they come in all shapes and sizes, and, you know, you can just do your best to try and pick the right one.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you seem to have a knack for that. We'll get into that in a little bit. But I want to talk some more about some of the trainers you work for. So, Tommy Stack, obviously, you know, he's a very talented trainer. He's also good at cashing tickets, which is something I like. And
they are. His son Fozzie now has taken over the trainer's license, you know, but and they have a fabulous facility down there for I couldn't recommend it highly enough for anybody who's trained in Ireland. It's a beautiful private facility. You have the, all-weather gallops, the grass gallops. I mean, the place is fabulous, right there in Golden and Tipperary.
Well, you mentioned working for David Hanley and then being upset when he came to the United States, but it wasn't too long after that that you came to the United States and your friends get you a job with Al Stahl Jr., and this happens.
Zenyatta now hooking to the grandstand side, and Zenyatta is now coming with a run, looking at Lucky Blame. Blame on the inside, Blame gets the lead. Zenyatta on the outside, looking at Lucky Blame. Zenyatta is flying. Blame trying to hold on. Blame, and Zenyatta! Blame has won it ahead. Zenyatta ran her heart out, but had to settle for second.
So you go to work for Al Stahl and he wins the biggest race in the country. What was that like?
That was fabulous. I think it was, that was all me. I was his lucky charm when I went into the barn.
Job security, right? Can't get rid of this guy.
No, I just got so lucky when I came over. And like you said, there was a couple of my friends, Brian Murphy and John Innes, who are both doing very well in their own right now. Both training and pre-training horses in Lexington. But they had Al Stahl who was looking for a rider, and they got me in there, and I didn't know who Al Stahl was at the time, or too many American trainers, to be honest. And I was in there, and I was just awestruck with the amount of talent and horses he had. He had that barn in Rice Road there in Lexington, and a lot of those Claiborne horses were there, and they're just well-bred, beautiful to look at, beautiful to ride, and, Blame happened to be there at the time. I'd like to say I got to ride him, but Al kept me off him. I thought as well his lead horse and his breezes and stuff, but they were good horses too, the likes of Apart. He's a grade 3 winner. I used to ride him, against Blame in his work, and it was just thrilling to be, riding those kind of horses and breezing fast coming down the lane. You're realizing what good horses feel like in America.
Yeah. Well, Al, I love Al Stahl. I think he's a great guy. He's a fantastic trainer. He does such a great job, and he's an upstanding human being. What was it like working for Al?
It's a dream, Everything is just a relaxed atmosphere. Everything goes smoothly, and he does things right, at his own pace, and everything is, there's no stone unturned with him, Everything is nice and clean. The horses are done 100%. He does. He's a fabulous trainer. Does a great job. And like you said, he's a stand-up human being, and he's got a lovely wife and kids, and, which you'd expect, because Mal is a great guy, and that's what he deserves.
I've known Al for, probably 30 years, but does he ever get mad? I've never seen him, really be angry.
I haven't seen him either, but I haven't tried to provoke him that much.
Yeah, don't poke the bear, right?
Yeah. Well, why mess up a good thing, Nice, pleasant. Leave him alone.
He's very even keel for a trainer, because usually trainers get up and down and stuff, but Al's pretty much the same every day, which I really admire, because a lot of times you run into those trainers that they wear their heart on their sleeve, and it's kind of hard to work with them sometimes.
It is a little bit. It is. But so, Al, he seems very level-headed, and he understands the game completely. You have to try stay level-headed, because the highs are high and the lows are low in this game, so you can't let it get you too much. Otherwise, your blood pressure will be through the roof.
Yeah, no kidding. We've got enough pressure on us already. So
yeah.
So when you were done with Al, you moved over to a different aspect of the business, which I think has helped you a lot in your current training regimen. You went to Niall Brennan, who's one of the great consigners in our sport today.
I did, and that's basically thanks to David Hanley as well, because when I came to America, I still didn't know what path I wanted to take as a career here. And I talked to David, and he was the one that suggested that maybe I go down to Niall, you know, and see how they, the two-year-old system works here, you know, because Niall gets a lot of horses in from year in and gets them broken, and a lot of them go to the sales, or even a lot of them don't go to the sales, but he still prepares them and pre-trains them and then sends them out to their trainers. And what a fabulous place he has down there, and a fabulous job him and his team does. He's very similar to Al's demeanor. They're both very level-headed. I've never seen Niall get mad either. They just, if things go wrong, they regroup and sort it out. They don't throw buckets down the shed row or, you know, F-bombs or any of that. They just, you know, they work with it. They make it work if things are going to go wrong. So you have to keep a cool head and get it back on track.
Yeah, I've known a lot of people that have worked for Niall Brennan, and they just have thoroughly enjoyed their experiences there, and have learned a lot. He must be a fantastic teacher.
Ah, he is. He knows a lot, but you can't tell him that to his face. He's got a big head. Niall is great. I love meeting him at the sales, and you know, typical Irish people would be slagging each other a bit, a little bit of banter, but thank him enough for, you know, singing his praises, because he does a great job down there. And his son Colin, who's his assistant there now, he does a great job, and they have a great team down there.
Did he give you any pointers as to what to look for when you buy a horse?
Well, you know, he has nice horses down there, so, you know, he'd always be pointing out the nice ones to you. And kind of you learn from looking at nice horses. You know, you see what a nice horse is meant to look like. And it's back to that scenario again. There might be two good horses there together, but I like one of them more than the other. But they could both equally be as good. It's like you pick the red one or the black car, you know, it's whichever is your preference, but they're both equally as good. But, you know, they have to be balanced. They have to be look athletic. They have to be correct as they can be. They have to be good if they're wind. And look like athletes is the main thing.
Yeah.
And if they can have a bit of pedigree as well, that's even better.
I always encourage people when they go to the races to go to the paddock. It's always amazing to me that a lot of people go to the track and they never even go look at the horses. They might see them, you know, from a distance in the grandstand or whatever, but they don't get up close and personal. And I think more people would enjoy their day and learn more about the sport if they went to the paddock once in a while.
They would, I think. You know, and I'm a big fan of that as well, because you see how a horse is handling the occasion. If they're, you know, if they're too much on edge or if they're relaxed demeanor. And once the occasion isn't getting them, it's nice to see them around the paddock. You know, what way they act and hold themselves.
Yeah, yeah, it's important, I think. After you were through with Niall, I guess you went to Bill Mott at Payson Park and galloped for him for a couple of months?
Yeah, I just got into Payson Park for a couple of months, and like, he's fabulous horses again. You know, you've run the Greek, Flat House, Royal Delta was there, and a few other good horses that I don't remember at the time, but he had plenty of nice horses. And Payson is a good facility as well. They have a great dirt track, and they have a grass track. And the thing I enjoy most about that is they've got paddocks there, so they'd be turning them out. There's a good horse to get a chance to be turned out over the winter before they ride, you know, or after they ride, or they've got round pens there, and maybe the boys will go out to a round pen and have a bucket of play before they go to the track, and the girls will go to the paddock and have their bucket of play there. It's a nice, relaxed atmosphere down there in Tate, and you know, horses seem to do good down there.
Yeah, it's very relaxed, and they do have those little areas where they can get a break and, as people like to say, be a horse for a while.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, it's like anything. I think that only suits some horses, you know. Not every horse is going to enjoy being turned out. I did it myself. You know, you'll turn them out and they're so used to being inside and start pacing the fence and stuff like that. But that's where the horsemanship comes into it. You know your horse and do the best you can by him. If he doesn't like being turned out, you don't turn him out. You take him out in the shank for a pick of grass there for 30 minutes, and he's much happier doing that and then go back into his stall.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's very nice. So like all artists, they go through phases, and being a horse trainer is kind of like being an artist. You went through a gentleman trainer phase, Michael Matz, Owen Hardy, and Andrew McKeever. Talk about those three guys.
Michael, I went down to him in Palm Meadows, I believe. Yeah, that's where it was. And, you know, Palm Meadows is a beautiful facility, and I enjoyed being there. Because it's like the Ritz Hotel for horses, I guess you could say. Barns are lovely, the horse paths are lovely, track, everything. It was when I was there anyway. I've been there for a good while now, but everything seemed really nice there. And Michael is a good guy as well. Good crew. You know, I think it's very important. You got to work for people and with people that you like and get on with and respect. You know, you can't be going in there working for somebody and say, well, I hear he's a bit of a so-and-so, but, you know, he might be able to teach me something. You have to be going in there saying, wow, this is a really good guy, and I think I can learn a lot from him, and I'm going to enjoy working for him or with him. So, you know, all these people I've worked for, I've enjoyed working for him, and I'd work for him again. I've never, been anywhere for long and left and said, oh, I hated that place, but I'm going to get out, you know?
Yeah.
And,
well,
the good thing about the racetrack is there's all those good trainers are always looking for capable riders and people. I've been lucky that I've, you know, been a pretty good rider, you know, all my life. So it's they're kind of always in demand, you know. And I'm in the same situation now myself, you know. I'm always on the lookout for other good riders to bring in and, you know, have on your team, because they're a hot commodity and they're getting harder to find.
Yeah, well, team building is so important in today's day and age where trainers have a lot more horses than they used to take care of in the past, and they need sometimes a far-flung operation. You'll have, you know, several horses at one track and more horses at another track, and you need that team to get over the hump and get to the next stage of your career.
You do. I like Michael was very lucky down there as well. He had two good assistants, Peter Brett and Josh Avila, and they could both ride as well, you know, which is a big thing. So if you got to separate your string or horses anywhere, they can take care of it.
Right.
You know, then I went to Saratoga then for Owen Harty, and it was Brian Ainge was his assistant. So it was kind of just me and Brian, and that was a great experience to get to see Saratoga and have a good steady job. And they had horses for Darley as well, so we used to get over to Green Tree with horses there, so you used to get to see the track there at the back of Saratoga as well.
Yeah.
To see it all and experience it, and it was a lot of fun and along the way.
Yeah, it's a cool place. Well, we hope everybody's enjoying this visit with Jeremiah O'Dwyer. I'm having a great time, and we're going to take a quick break here and come back and talk some more.
Nominate now to the 2019 Fasig Tipton Gulfstream Selected 2-Year-Old and Training Sale. The Gulfstream Sale was the number one ranked 2-year-old sale in 2018 by ROR on pinhooks and percentage of profitable pinhooks, with an average of more than $385,000 and a median of $295,000. And more horses sold for $1 million or more than any other 2-year-old sale in America last year. It's the Fasig Tipton Gulfstream Sale, March 27th, 2019. Nominate now at FasigTipton.com.
Now standing at Buck Pond Farm, Bet on Red, Wildcat Red.
Wildcat Red runs away to an impressive score in the Hutchison.
After winning the Grade 3 Hutchison, Wildcat Red goes on to win the Grade 2 Fountain of Youth in near record time. Faster than Pulpit, faster than Thunder Gulch, and faster than 49er. Multiple graded stakes winner and Grade 1 performing millionaire, Wildcat Red. Also standing at Buck Pond, V.E. Day. After winning three in a row at Belmont and Saratoga, V.E. Day wins the Grade 1 Traverse in one of the most exciting finishes in history with a speed rating of 112.
But here comes V.E. Day with a final try. Who will win the Traverse? It will be too close to call.
Major League Belmont and Saratoga talent, V.E. Day. For more information, contact Buck Pond Farm at www.buckpond.com.
You know, it's never too late to start talking racing at Woodbine. Major race dates you can look forward to later this year include the Woodbine Oaks on June 8th, the Queen's Plate June 29th, the Woodbine Mile September 14th, the Grade 1 Summer in Natalma Stakes on September 15th, and the Grade 1 Canadian International October 12th. Opening day at Woodbine, April 20th, turf racing beginning mid-May. Tickets on sale for the two-day Queen's Plate Festival right now. Visit woodbine.com/Queen's Plate.
Bloom Racing.
Sky Diamonds takes the lead. Sky Diamonds to win, going away.
Started by former jockey and 35-year racing industry veteran Jeffrey Bloom, Bloom Racing offers racing partnerships, bloodstock services, pinhooking, and private race management.
Midnight Bizou with another assertive final furlong. The top filly of the meet deservedly wins the Grade 1 Santa Anita Oaks.
Experience the fun, excitement, and exclusive access of racehorse ownership with Bloom Racing. Forming racing partnerships now. Get in on the action at bloomracing.com.
In the morning, I'm always looking for talent. With Always Dreaming, it was always about his athleticism. He's like a halfback. When he hit that hole, he exploded and hit another gear. In my experience, horses like Always Dreaming, they stamp their offspring with that ability. I'm racing with Bruno, and this breeding season, I'm Always Dreaming.
I'm here with Dr. Jim Chiappetta of Flair Equine Nasal Strips. Jim, exactly how do the Flair strips work?
Mike, remember that a horse only breathes through its nose when it's running. About 50% of the resistance to getting the oxygen through the nose and into the lungs is at the nasal passages. They're the narrowest part of the upper airway, and that's where Flair strips work. The strips are proven to help prevent the nasal passages from collapsing, so horses breathe easier and get the oxygen they need more efficiently.
Learn more at flarestrips.com/learn.
This is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
As they come toward the quarter pole, then at S2, Why Cowgirls Like Us. Grand Daria still has five lengths to find. And Mandy Blue up the inside. They come for home with under a quarter of a mile to go. Three quarters in 1 minute 15.83 seconds. Needs supervision. NS2 charges on the outside. Then Leora, Funfinder drop back on the outside. Is Grand Daria, Cowgirls Like Us, and Mandy Blue. They come inside the final 16th. And it's Needs Supervision on the outside. NS2 with Joe Rocco Jr. Needs Supervision has won the Silver Bullet Day Stakes. Three quarters length to RS2. Grand Daria was third, beaten by a half dozen lengths. Leora was next across from Cowgirls Like Us, Mandy Blue, and Funfinder.
Welcome back to Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. This is Jude Feld with our special guest, trainer Jeremiah O'Dwyer. And I want to remind you that if you missed any portion of this show, it will be archived on our website, horseracingradio.net, and is also available at Horse Racing Radio Network on iTunes. Well, we just heard the stretch run of Need Supervision in the Silver Bullet Day Stakes at Fairgrounds earlier this year. Jerry, tell us about her. How'd you get her, and what's she up to?
I just have to get goosebumps there now, here, like falling in, dude.
Yeah, I did that just for you.
Thank you very much. Well, I bought her at Fasig Tipton in Timonium last year at the two-year-old sale. So we were up there, we were shopping, and came across her, liked her, and saw her the second time and loved her. Saw her the third time until we couldn't afford her. So there was a lot going on. And I had her on my list, but then she was going to go above the budget I had at the time. So I still went into the ring and I watched her go through, and I saw that she RNA'd. And I was after speaking to Mike McMahon beforehand. He had her with partners in Hiddenbrook. And I just got chatting to him after she RNA'd, and he basically asked me why didn't I buy her. And I told him, you know, she was just above her budget at the time. Then we worked out a deal, and I got her bought for a client of mine.
That worked out good, huh?
It sure did. It sure did. I mean, she was like, you know, one of my top picks in the sale. And we got her, and we saw her x-rays and everything, and there was not much wrong with her, but we still opted to give her a little time off. So, you know, sometimes owners can get a little impatient. So I called him before I signed his money away and told him this is what I'd like to do with her, was get her and give her, like, I think it was 30, 60 days off. And he was good with that, and that's what we did. And we brought her back, and she never missed a beat after that. She just continued to improve and steady progress along, and we just kept stepping up her work gradually until she was ready to debut. And she went to Penn National, and I was after, she's after Breeze with another filly that I'd won a maiden special with, and I thought she was a bit better, so she went to Penn National, and I thought, if anything, it'd be to be just a bit of greenness, but I still thought she'd be good enough to overcome it and win. But sure enough, she went and she got beat by half a length. You know, she did everything wrong and was still only beaten half a length. She broke a bit slow, rushed up, blew the turn, and I think was a little bit, didn't know what was happening then when she was in front. But look, it's a blessing in disguise, like, because she didn't have to take on winners, and straight away she got to come back and run in another maiden and get a bit more experience, and she was a lot more professional. You know, she was a quick learner. She came back to Laurel and beat a few nice fillies in there that are all after coming back and doing well. So we just, you know, she kept progressing along for us, and I was deciding what to do after she won her maiden, and I knew she was pretty decent, so I was trying to decide the next move. And luckily enough, they had that the Stars of Tomorrow card for Miss Churchill for all the two-year-olds. So I decided to go there with her. And fair enough, she went there, and she won like a good thing, which, you know, surprised me and a lot of people, I suppose. You know, you're taking on a lot of big operations and horses that have proved that they'd compete at the highest level already. So for her to go and do that, it was a very special day, you know, because it cemented my faith in thinking that we had a very good filly. I just didn't know how good when we were going there.
Well, that is kind of a big day now where people like to showcase their flashy two-year-olds and stuff. So it puts a little extra pressure, as Wayne Lucas would say, when the whole world is watching.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and everybody is, because these are all, you know, all them races are pointing to the bigger three-year-old days. You know, like you said, everybody is watching, because anybody who has an eye for it are probably going to go there. Like, they're showcasing them, but there's also a lot of money on offer. Wherever there's a lot of money on offer, there's a lot of good competition on offer also.
Yeah, that's
so,
right.
So, you know, it's a good place to find out if you are going to be able to compete against the big boys or not with a horse.
Well, she certainly came through in the Silver Bullet day. I understand that was your first stakes win as a trainer?
It was, yeah, it was. It was a very special day, and it was very special that the new owners, you know, left her with me, you know, because it is hard to pay a lot of money, I understand it, for, you know, some big owners, and they're leaving her with this little guy that hardly anybody knows of, or, you know, has never had a stakes winner. You know, they're always wondering if they're going to do the best they can for him, you know, and I'm just delighted that they did leave her with me, and she was able to repay their faith by winning the Silver Bullet this day.
Well, you have a very good record of picking out horses, and a lot of times you put up your own money when you do it. You have a very unique way of approaching sales. If what I read was accurate, it said you start with the Breeze videos at the two-year-old sales, and you just watch the horses breeze. You don't look at the book or anything, just you try to get a feel for the horse and the way that they move. Is that correct?
That's right. But that's because I'm not dealing with a big budget, you know. I still think I do it that way anyway. I think you have to look at all the horses breeze and see what catches your eye. Like, I think a lot of the time I like horses that breeze 10 and 2, 10 and 3. You get to see their action a little bit better, of how they're using themselves and all that. But I definitely watch all the breezes of every horse and quickly mark off what catches my eye, what doesn't, and anything. I'll make a list of everything I've liked or thought I might like, and then I'll go through their pedigree and see what I might be able to afford or not afford. And then we go and inspect them, and the first look is always getting a feel for them, and then you mark off what you think you might like to see again. And it's when you go, my feel is when I go see them the second time, you know, if I still like them then, that's a good thing. Cause a lot of times you go back and see them the second time, and you're like, well, how did I like this the first time, you know?
Right.
It's like, you know, it's like, yeah. You just got to get him. It's like looking at a girl in the bar. You know, she walks by you the first time. She's all right. She comes back again. You're like, oh, holy, listen at the beard hug.
You sound just like me. I tell people that all the time. I mean, because when I shortlist for people, I can go through a barn relatively quickly. But you know, you ever walk into a bar, there's like three girls that you find attractive, and those are the ones you got to concentrate on, because the other ones, you know, it doesn't matter. And it's the same with the horses. I mean, they lead the horses out, and you almost know right away, especially when you have experience, when you've done it for a long time and you know what works for you. And you know, I'm sure with all the horses that you've ridden, galloped, trained, you know, you just have a feeling right away whether you like one or not. And sometimes a horse will grow on you, but very rarely.
Yeah, I agree 100%. Like, it's my dad has a great saying that I live by, and he says, I'll just do your own thing. You know, like a lot of the times I'll go around on my own because I don't like people influencing my decision. You know, I like to just go on my own, and then if I, you know, I don't mind people coming with me, but I like to use my own judgment first, you know, and then if I'm unsure, I might get somebody to go and have a look at it with me and see what they think and see if they're seeing what I'm seeing or not. But a lot of the time I don't like people influencing me. You know, you have to... Getting back to the girl situation, you can't tell somebody what girl they should like or shouldn't like, you know. It's
right.
Whatever you like. So you try not to let people influence you, you know. Like sometimes you go to consigners, and I like, there's lots of people I trust in the sales now, and I go to their barn and I tell them, look for two or three horses, and they say, well, look, I have this one here that I think you should look at. It's nice. It didn't breathe as good as it should. And that's good. That's very beneficial, because people start to understand what you're looking for and know what you want, and you know, they'll pull out some horses that you might not have on your list, and you might look and you say, well, you know, that's so bad, you know. It actually happened to me yesterday at Keeneland. Like, I bought one, and I didn't have him on my list because I thought he was going to bring way too much money over my budget. So, and I had him marked off as I Love You Breeze, and he was a horse I really liked. And then I looked at what they paid for him, or well, they actually RNA'd him as a yearling, and his pedigree, and I was like, oh, I'm not going to really get near this guy. But I went up to the consignment, and I was looking at a couple of others, and then one of the girls there, she said to me, well, you should really look at his horse. And I said, I have him marked off. This is what I thought, he'd be way too expensive. And then I talked to the consigner, and they told me what they thought they were going to reserve him at. So I looked at him, and I'm delighted, you know. And I still didn't think I'd be able to get him, though, because he was very nice. But I ended up buying him yesterday, and I really wouldn't have money for the new and trust that was there and mentioned it to me.
Right, right. Well, you know, when I was enjoying reading about your exploits and stuff, because I never had a big budget when I was training horses either, and sometimes you have to pull out all the stops. You got to resort to whatever tactics you can to get yourself a nice horse, and sometimes you may scratch a horse off because you've never heard of the sire or whatever, and that could be a really good looking individual. So if yeah. one of the consigners puts you onto a horse, it only takes a couple minutes to look. You can always say no, you know. But yeah, but once exactly. in a while, somebody will come up with something. You go, wow, that one's not too bad, and I can yeah. probably afford it.
Yeah, exactly. I never scratch one because of what it's by or whatever. But like I said, my first thing to do is look at all their breezes, you know, and to see what I like. And if I didn't like his breeze, you know, I'm probably not going to look at it, you know. Or if I'm on the fence, I'll go look at it again, his breeze, and see if I still like it or try and make a case for it. And if I don't, I 9 times out of 10, I won't go look at it. Because there's just so many there to try and get through. And you have to, you know, you're not going to get to see, like, go to April here now, I don't know how many horses are in there. How many hundreds. You know, I won't be able to get to see them all. So I wanted time to get down there and see them all. So I got to use my own intuition of what I like off the breeze shows and then go and take out and see as many as I can.
Well, it seems like your process is a good one. It really works. You've bought a lot of nice two-year-olds at sale, and so I wouldn't change anything. Even if you get to the Dwayne Lucas stage of bankroll,
yeah,
I'd stick to your guns because you've got system down.
For sure. No, yeah, you have to. It's like being a trainer. You have to stick what works for you. You know, that's getting your results. You know, you can always tweak little things, but you're never going to change it too much.
Right.
You gotta use what's working for you and try to improve on it, not really change everything about it, but just improving it a little bit every year. And that's what we want to do. You know, you're always trying to get a better class of horse. And, you know, it is nicer when you have a little bit more of a bankroll to try buy something with a bit more pedigree. You know, pedigree always helps. You know, it's what the whole foundation of thoroughbreds and good horses were built on. You know, and if you buy a nice horse and even a colt, it's to win a lot of grade ones for anybody to really want to stand them if he doesn't have much pedigree.
Right, that's right.
So, so, you know, if you have a little bit more bankroll, you can buy a nice horse with a little bit of pedigree. If you don't, you're probably just buying a nice horse and hoping he's a stone cold runner and make bankroll that way.
Yeah. Well, but
we have been lucky.
Go ahead.
Sorry, I was just saying, we have been lucky with all the two-year-olds we bought last year. I think it was only, we bought four or five, and there's only like one of them who hasn't broke his maiden yet, but all the others have, and they're all turned out to be nice and profitable, thank God.
That's great. Yeah, you know, I was reading, too, that your fiancé, Allison Willoughby, has been instrumental in helping you get some clients. Some friends of hers are in the game, and talk about that. Talk about how great it is to have a partner that really understands horse racing.
It's super. Like she's great. You know, I'm a bit reserved. I'm not very good at putting myself out there. You know, I wouldn't go up to anybody big and say, you know, here you go, would you send me a horse? I have to get a bit better at reaching out to things. And, you know, she's good at stoking me up and telling me, you know, I should send an email to this guy or that guy. Or, you know, if I had an owner already and then they don't have anything right now, she'd be able to send me, you know, to reach out to them again. Maybe they have another one or they want to get involved in another one. Like that, I need those little pushes, you know, just to motivate me to do that. Like she's been great. Like she has family friends. So her dad and mom, good friends of those. They own Howling Pigeon Farms, and they've been best friends since high school. So they actually wanted to get into the horse racing, and we've been very lucky for them. The first horse we bought, we did well and sold it for a profit, and then everything he's had was, you know, been good. They've all won and they've been having a lot of fun, you know. But like, obviously through Allison, if I didn't have Allison, I wouldn't have met those people. So it's a huge thing. And you know, I don't believe everybody says somebody is self-made, and I don't agree with that. But everybody needs somebody, you know, to help you along. And you know, you're self-made millionaire, you sold a bunch of stuff. People had to buy the stuff off you, so they're actually helping you, you know?
Right.
So it's you know, everybody needs help. There's no doubt about it. You can't do everything on your own, so you just need to get some good people around you. And I've been lucky that, you know, good people have come to me or have been around good people. And, like, Alison is just, you know, she's fabulous, you know what I mean? She keeps things going, and she understands I'm away a lot. I'll be going to the sales a lot or going to different racetracks, and she's very tolerant, you know. Maybe when we get married here in June, she might stop all that, but hopefully not.
She's delighted when you go out of town. Trust me on this. The nice thing about doing well for your in-laws is it sure makes Thanksgiving and Christmas dinners a lot nicer.
It does. Yeah, they're great. Allison's parents are great people. So they come over a lot to us on the East Coast, and we go out to them in Colorado, and we actually all went to Ireland for Christmas last year. So that was their first time meeting my parents and all the family, and the big welcome. They all passed the test. I was told that they'd be allowed to come back anytime, so that's kind of good.
That's good. One big happy family. That's great.
But like, you know, you do need the owners and people to invest in you and your ability and help you get more night hours. You know, it's and that's what I want to do. Like, I don't want to keep having a bunch of, you know, claimers. Like, they're great and you need them, you know, and you're going to start off with them, and I still have them, but you want to keep trying to build and expand to get better horses. You know, I'd prefer to have 20 nice horses than 100 moderate horses.
Right.
That's just, you know, that's the way I look at it. Well, where we are in Maryland, Laurel is a beautiful facility. You know, I just got lucky to go up there as by chance as well. I had three horses of my own that I was wanting to run and was coming to the winter, and I didn't really want to run them at Turfway, to be honest, because the money was so bad and I thought they had a bit of ability. So I took, I think, three trips up to Laurel Park over the winter, and two times we'd winners, so kind of put in a stall app just on a whim, and they gave me some stalls, and I went up to three, and now we have, we're up to 15 right now.
Oh, that's great.
So, yeah, no, it's good. It's been very good to me now, Laurel, and I mean, the track is, it's a great place to train. I'd recommend it to anyone. Track a mile in an eighth round, it's great surface, and they're going to have, they've like two turf tracks there as well, so the turf is going to start up here real soon, and the facility is fabulous. Like, the whole grandstand are pumping a load of money into it, and it's just a great place. I wish it'd get a little busier with patrons, but I'm sure it will, you know?
Yeah.
I'm sure it will.
Well, a lot of people are talking about it. Eventually, I think they're going to get the Breeders' Cup there. And Maryland is such a great racing state. It has such a long and storied history, and the people there are very loyal to Maryland racing. I think it's just an outstanding place to be, really.
It is, and you have a lot of, you know, tracks close by as well, which is great. And I very rarely, well, I ship out the odd time when I have that, or, you know, there's not a suitable race there for my horse, or, you know, but most of it, I just love running there. I don't want to ship out unless I really have to. Because they've got good maidens, good horses come out of there the whole time. The purses are good. The competition is good. You know, and the races are very fair. You know, it's there's not very many times you get unlucky there, because, like I said, the track is just such a big, big open galloping track. You know, you have to be very unlucky for the best horse not to win most of the time.
Yeah, that's great when there's, you know, there's not too many track biases and things that you have to overcome, because it's tough enough to train horses without having to deal with all that kind of stuff as well.
It sure is. It sure is. Yeah.
So are 2-year-olds like your favorite kind of horse to train, or
For sure. Yeah, for sure. I love educating them and bringing them along. You know, my big thing is if they're, you know, even if they're not, don't turn out to be superstars, at least if you have, you do the best you can by them early, it gives them the best chance later on. Even if you have to run them in a claimer and they're taken off yet, they do everything properly, and, you know, they don't have to be rebroke to anything or a different way. But, you know, I had 2 2-year-olds come out of the gate there this morning. It was really their first time breaking, and the guys just taught me they were brilliant, because we just kept going back every day, just slowly away with them, get them walking in, standing, jogging out. And then all of a sudden, when you don't scare them or frighten them, the penny just drops on them what they want you to do. Horses, they just, all they want to do is please you, you know. If you're kind to them, they're so kind to you and willing. And then, you know, the main thing is, I think, not to overfear them, you know, if it's a 20 grand claimer and there's a 20 grand race, don't be trying to run it in a 40 grand race. Disappointed it every time.
Right.
You got to be realistic about it. You know, everything you buy is not going to be a superstar. Everything's not going to work out. But I think that the biggest thing is to try and 10 times what level they're at sooner rather than later, you know.
Yeah, because you see so many horses
running and maybe special weight from 15, 20 starts. And then you drop them down to a level where they should have been at, you know, maybe 10 starts ago, and they probably can't win there now. They're like people, you know what I mean? They'll get discouraged, you know. I run against you, or I'll point to you and me as an example, because I'm pretty fast.
Oh, you'll beat me every time, I'll tell you that much.
But, you know, if you're running against a professional athlete and you keep beating him, eventually you're just not going to say, oh, bugger with us, you know, let him off. I'm not going to beat him anyway. But if you can be in against your own group, you know, you're like, oh, I've got a shot here, you know. And everybody likes to win. People like to win. Horses like to win. Dogs run. They like to win. It's the nature of the beast. Humans included, you know?
Absolutely. I firmly believe that the horses know when they're in a field they can beat. I mean, you go to put the saddle on a horse sometimes, and they're all pumped up. It's like they know, I can win this race. And other times you put the saddle on the same horse, and maybe he's overmatched, and he's just walking around there like, you know, defeated already. Yeah.
You can definitely see it, like, after if a horse wins a race or two, you do notice the change. I'm back in the barn, they're like, you know, I'm the man, you know. They know they're after, you know, beating up with some other horses, you know.
Yeah, yeah, they get pumped up.
It is a confidence thing, yeah, without doubt.
I'm glad you agree, because people don't believe me when I tell them that, you know, but it's true.
Yeah, you know, it's very true, you know. It is very true. You should just ask them people to run against somebody they think they can beat. I bet you they'll run a lot harder than somebody they're pretty sure that they can beat.
Yeah.
Horses, they're fabulous. If you treat them right and do right by them, they'll give you their all every time. Every time.
Yeah, they're very genuine animals. So we're getting towards the end of the show here, and we always like to ask what a trainer likes to do when he's not at the barn. And do you have any hobbies or things you enjoy away from the racetrack?
God, that's hard to describe now, because I'm not very good at any sport. I might play golf once every 6 or 8 months. Terrible at it. Alison does drag me off every now and again with her adventures. So I go out and ride one of those, and she bosses me around, tells me what to do with them. She does a very good job with them. But I don't do that much. I like to run a bit. I will go for a run, you know, a couple of times a week. Enjoy running and getting out, and don't drink. I've given up. Well, I do drink, but I've given up for Lent. So
there
40
you go.
Days doing nothing. So
a lot more running and less drinking, huh?
Yeah. Well, I tell you, this trainer's life is not a life for big drinkers, because you got to get up early every morning.
That's right.
So it's not easy to do that. But, you know, I love a social drink here and there as well. But I suppose when I get married here in June, I'll have to have a drink before that, or maybe before, because she might not be drinking after it. So better be careful.
I bet you she's a lot more understanding than you think.
I know, but I do like it. I like going off there with Alison, and, you know, we'll hang out with her horses and stuff, and, you know, watch a bit of TV and downtime. But I don't have too many other hobbies at the moment, especially now, because I keep so busy trying to get things going, you know, to the next level. You know, you've gone from 3 horses up to 15, and kind of want more, and you're kind of always thinking and planning of what horse fits where and where to put him and where the next good one is going to come from. So you're usually pretty tired in the afternoon when you get home.
Yeah, well, you're in a very big fraternity. Most trainers, they're at the barn all the time. So.
Yeah, exactly.
Well,
yeah.
I really appreciate you spending time with us today. I want to thank you for taking the time, and we had a lot of fun. It's a great show.
Great. Thanks very much, Jude, and wish you all the best.
All right.
See you soon.
Well, that hour went fast. Thanks to Jeremiah O'Dwyer for sharing his story. We hope that he has all the best of luck as his career moves ahead. Special thank you to Lee Delapin, our producer, for keeping us online and in time. And don't forget to listen to the Equine Forum, Sirius 219, XM 201, every Saturday at 8.